Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing reparation for Africa or African descendants, confronting history and seeking justice. I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Makini Chisom-Straka. Makini is a freelance reparations consultant. She's also associate professor of emergency medicine and former visiting scholar, associate professor of history, Yale University, where she examined the potential manifestations of structural reparations for U.S. Blacks and reconciling with decolonization and land back to indigenous nations. Makini, I've just read your recent post on a very interesting one on elite white lies. So I definitely look forward. It's a pleasure to have you join me. I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's a deep honor.
Brilliant. So let me start off with this. So in recent times, we've seen this subject of reparations in the UK, in the US. What is behind this recent surge, and what is this concept of reparations in?
Well, I think we should start with the latter question before the former, which is what is reparations? It's a conversation that has been happening, frankly, for centuries, but it's not only or explicitly about race, although that has been the most recent manifestation of it. Reparations, the word in and of itself means to make repair, right? It is about getting in right relationship. Another way that I like to frame it is if folks are familiar with 12-step programs for folks who are in Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, these are 12-step programs, and one of the steps is making amends. So it's thinking about the folks that you have harmed, that you care about, but that you harmed in the process of dealing with the substance use disorder, and meeting with them, and not just apologizing, absolutely apologizing, but also offering up the ways in which you are going to be different, act different, walk different, talk different, to demonstrate your new way of being in the world. That is how you make amends. It's not just the sorry, it's actually having different ways of being. And so that's reparations. It's saying, ooh, there was an error here. There was a harm committed. Not only am I apologizing for that harm, not only are we as a group, for example, apologizing for that harm, but we also are going to move forward in a new way so that that harm isn't possible again. That's reparations. That's repair. And in the U.S., specifically, reparations has been a conversation, even when that term wasn't used, from colonizer contact with indigenous nations, when that contact was harmful. And then after race-based slavery, interestingly, the U.S. actually paid reparations to enslavers. In D.C., Abraham Lincoln said, oh, yes, people have been, now that the 13th Amendment has abolished legalized slavery, except for the 13th Amendment loophole, which we can talk about if you want. But now that these folks have been freed, white enslavers have lost their property, meaning humans, people who are Black, African descendant. And so they paid them for their loss of property. And so that was actually the United States first and really only real effort at reparations as a federal government. But it was to the people who did the enslaving, which is the opposite of the way that people talk about reparations or think about it now. I think the most commonly known example, at least in the US, is when Germany made reparations to the Jewish people. We know that during the Holocaust, millions of people who weren't even Jewish, who were Roma, who were Black, who were queer, were also murdered. But specifically, the Jewish population received financial reparations, but also Germany changed policy in the effort to make that impossible to happen again in their nation. In the US, we've had reparations, financial reparations, for example, to survivors of Japanese internment during World War II. And so it's not that reparations can't be done, right? It's a question of willingness and interest in doing so. And there is something important, I think, to think about when we talk about reparations in the US in particular, a few things to consider. One, the US is a currency issuer. So the federal government has the means to financially pay. Like, that's really not an issue. Of whether the federal government wants to, whether people in the US will create a democracy that is actually representative, number one, which we don't have as yet. And number two, is going to choose people who will support that kind of action. But financial reparations aren't enough because they don't change the system, the structures that allowed internment of Japanese people to happen again. And so we saw after 9/11, the Patriot Act was passed in the US and Guantanamo Bay was used to house and torture people who were concerned. There was concern that they might be terrorists or associated with terrorists. And so we see that in the name of national security, nothing has changed, even though financial reparations were paid to Japanese survivors, to the Nisei and the Sansei. So it's not, for me, it's not just about financial reparations. Policy-based reparations is super important. Why now? Sir Hilary Beckles says that this is the century for reparations. Every century, I guess, has its thing. Last century was about fighting apartheid and civil rights, fighting for civil rights. And these are the most basic. These are minimum civil, like civil rights are like not really a big leap, right? It wasn't housing for all. It wasn't living wage job for all. It wasn't any, it was just like the right to sit at the same table as someone who was white and be able to drink from the same water fountain. That's like low hanging fruit. Right? That's not asking for really anything. And that was only won through civil disobedience, through breaking the law, and through the participation and with the participation of white relatives who had to get arrested in order for this to come to fruition. So it wasn't enough for people who were harmed to say, this is unacceptable. We demand the barest minimum of rights. It had to also be the people who experience white privilege. So yeah, I couldn't really tell you the exact reason for why now, but when you look at sort of the confluence of the world, like the world feels like it's on fire. And I know that's probably always on fire, but now we have the internet. So we're so more aware. But it's when you look at all of that, people are frustrated, fed up, and understand that reparations are a sign of a willingness to change, of a willingness to value something more than just an economy and some people within that economy. That there is some understanding, I think, that economy isn't valuable in and of itself. An economy is meant to serve its people.
I think I agree with you. And I think I can add a little bit to why there might be that sort. So in America, I could look at the case of George Floyd. That had some kind of like global widespread, you know, even here in the UK, started seeing people uprooting symbols of, you know, colonialism and, you know, and you could also see imbalance and inequality all over the world. And people are beginning to see that these things have historical impact. These are not just current issues that are flaming this stuff. But you've mentioned many things that I like to mention. Now, you mentioned something about apology, which is even the basic. But like in the UK government, for instance, they've refused to apologize. And one of the reasons cited for that is apology is an acceptance of guilt. And then apology, when you apologize, then you can be liable to
financial
stuff. So why do you think, is this like plausible deniability? Are they denying, because like Riley said, even like in the Christian stuff, the stages of being born again, is you have to accept you're a sinner. That is the first stage. So if you can accept, if you can apologize, then you apologize for your sins. If you can apologize, does it mean they're denying that this thing happened? And these people demand some sort of atonement or restitution?
There are certainly, I think that I'm not sure necessarily how they would name themselves, but there are folks within the U.S. Maybe farther right side of the spectrum who would deny. So I think those are the minimum, but there are, or the minority, there are others who would say, it's just a fact of life. It happened. Like everyone was doing it. Like it was actually good for Black people because it got them to the US and look at the US now. And like, it's like, yes, look at the US now. That was on the backs and the stolen land of Indigenous and Black people. As well as other impoverished and marginalized groups, but at a population level, it was specifically on the basis of stolen land and stolen labor. But it's more that it's not so much that it didn't happen. It's more that the concern from my understanding, my interpretation is, if you take responsibility, then you are responsible. If you say you're sorry, right? An apology does mean an acceptance of, not me necessarily, if you're representing the federal government, then it's the federal government historically engaged in these actions over centuries. Now we're responsible for making amends. And when you look at the structure of the US federal government, it is not structured to want to change at its core, at its essence. And what I propose for policy-based reparations, for structural reparations, would mean a changing of the values of the US, or at least in addition to those values, which would be communal abundance. And communal abundance simply isn't possible or feasible without reparations at a policy level, at a national level. And so there is an unwillingness to value all lives in the United States, and especially the lives of people who have been devalued for centuries.
Let me take you up on that. I was going to, there's so many things, but let me take you up on that. I've read somewhere, maybe today, where Trump is looking to abolish some kind of like diversity. I read somewhere where some kind of like diversity stuff. So if we talk about, and some people have talked about like the UK Prime Minister, the opposition leader have said, you know, we need to just, or the chancellor has said, oh, we need to just move forward. We don't want to go back to the past. So if I translate that to mean what you mean by policy reparation, which is still the same thing, you can dance around it. It's still dealing with the implications of the past in
Absolutely.
The present.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So how do you see that moving forward when you see where there are still a lot of inequality, there's still a lot of among the races, among classes, among different kind of people. So how do you see that policy? You mentioned policy reparation. What would it look like? And can you explain it further? What do you mean?
Yeah, so that is the harder part, I would say. To me, the concept of reparations is simple and easy, right? You recognize that not only did the past happen, but the past continues to impact and negatively harm, in this conversation, Black people who live in the US. And understanding that it's not just slavery, it's all the badges of slavery, the policies that came after to attempt to, and actually did, reinstitute the incidence of slavery and or subordinate the Black status in the United States. And those policies are still in place, still in effect. So we still see disproportionately that Black people are harmed by these policies. So part of it is changing those policies so that, number one, at least for a time, and that time is not based on numbers, it's not 25 years as has been proposed by the Supreme Court previously, based on the actual impact, what we see, that at least for a time, those policies that are actually affirmative action for white people are shifted to be affirmative action for Black people, number one. Number two, shifting policies so that ultimately no particular group is disproportionately advantaged or disadvantaged. And the bigger underlying question for me is about how do we, what methodologies can we construct, can we co-create in community that allow us to achieve this vision, this goal of communal abundance without being beholden to the current US system? So without being concerned for whether SCOTUS is gonna catch feelings and try to do that, what they have done for centuries, which is conserve, preserve the system as it exists. The Supreme Court of the United States, for example, is conservative. It has always been. And I think it's important for people to recognize that, number one, the Supreme Court doesn't have judicial finality or authority given to it by the Constitution. So their word is not, that's it. Right? It's not, it's their interpretation. But even when we see that the Supreme Court is more diverse than it has ever been in US history, it maintains the system as it exists, the settler colonial capitalist system. And so I think the more challenging issue is, yes, if we make reparative policy changes for Black people and preserve this system, we continue then to harm our Native relatives. We continue then to uphold a settler colonial paradigm that is structured on the principles of extraction and exploitation. And in that scenario, communal abundance simply isn't possible. So that's complicated.
It's not complicated. I think I was going to ask you a question, but let me follow up on this. I think we are at a point where it is very glaring and obvious that the world needs a new system. There is some kind of like struggle for a global order. So and you could see President Trump kind of like threatening other kind of like geopolitical structure like the BRICS about using different currency. You could see different alliances being formed. You could see China. It is undeniable that the capitalist system is no longer sustainable, or that's a problem. But now, when you look at that, and I guess the question I want to ask is, what role does, I think it ties into the question I was going to ask. So we have people that defend, so people are divided. It's kind of like divide and rule, kind of like people are divided, and you have people like, let me say, for instance, Kanye West, with what Kanye West said something about the slavery stuff. And you have some people that are among the minorities that we want to fight for, that are also defending the system, the same system that you're talking about, because they are kind of like benefiting from it. So how does that frustrate or harm or challenge this fight for reparation?
Yeah, I mean, that is probably one of the biggest challenges to reparation. So I think there's two challenges. One, that the people who are empowered by the system, in settler colonial capitalist terms, they're empowered. Why would they want to change something that they're benefiting from, right? And the other challenge is the narrative around reparations. We've seen over the past 30 to 40 years in the United States, increasing support, including among white relatives, for reparations. Just the concept of it, not necessarily like the manifestations. Like, I think there's still a fair bit of conversation that needs to ensue for reparations to be co-created by communities in the United States. But of course, the people who are benefiting from the extraction and exploitation are not, naturally, they're gonna wanna hold on to that, because there is a fear and understanding that, oh, well, if I'm benefiting from extraction and exploitation, I only see the world in this one way. I can't envision a world in which I don't get harmed. Other people have, more people have power, and they don't then seek retribution. And so I think that's like a paradigm shift that those who are currently empowered struggle with, that no, the goal is not to hurt you. like that's, and I mean, it's a fundamental human concern, right? Like they have been taught and bought into this scarcity mentality, this fear of dispossession that I write about in the latest edition of RX Reparations, that they would be pushed out and deprived. And in upcoming editions, I'll dig more into that. But the upshot is no, like if that was gonna happen, if retribution, I mean, if you look at who, for example, is in the homes of people of means, of financial means, and taking care of their children and the elderly, it's in the US, it's largely women of color. Yeah. And so if we wanted revenge, would we be taking care? No. Right? Like you, a different world would have existed if revenge was what was being sought. Simply communal abundance and human rights are all that is being sought. And so there is a fear of people who are quote unquote at the top, i.e. benefiting from settler colonialism and capitalism, that they would then be, the roles would be switched. And that suddenly McKinney would have all the power and would be discounted. But I mean, I would even argue that people who think and are tangibly benefiting from settler colonialism and capitalism are actually harmed, because you can't be whole when other people around you who care for you, who live and coexist on this planet with you, are experiencing violence. That is a violence to your soul.
You know, this you mentioned something, I think I remember what I was going to say. There's something you mentioned about the kind of democracy that is not representative. And then you mentioned communal abundance and human rights. And these are issues, you're looking at a paradox in the democratic, so-called democratic system itself, as opposed to be democratic and supposed to promote human rights of but then again, you look at in the colonial system, if you look at Africa, for instance, the way the colonialists did around it is to describe certain people as not as a subject, not to use the word citizen. So I think in America as well, they have to define the blacks in a certain way to then, it is use the word property. So to use it in a way to then maybe justify such action. So I wanted to speak on that paradox and why we continue, again, in recent times, we've seen the kind of like double standard, what's going on in Israel, in you know, Israel and Hamas, which kind of bring it at the hypocrisy of world democracies. And that is what I'm doing at the moment, my research in terms of the utility of liberal democracy. Looking at, is liberal democracy worth it for those that have adopted it in Africa, for instance? So I wanted to speak on that system, because whatever system we're bringing would have to be one. Is it, are we reforming this system? Are we bringing a totally new system?
I mean, I would argue that the US doesn't really experience democracy if we look at simply how it's structured, right? Like, it's not truly a representative democracy. I vote, and then electors from the Electoral College vote again, quote unquote, on my behalf. But what's weird about that is they don't vote in proportion to who, how many people voted for, you know, candidate A versus candidate B versus candidate C. If candidate B wins the state, the Electoral College for that state goes for candidate B. So that's not a democracy, right? That's a winner take all situation when that doesn't actually represent how the people of New York, for example, voted, right? So it's not truly a representative democracy. So there's that. So even if we, for example, got rid of the Electoral College, that would already be a massive reform to the US system. And then we look at gerrymandering and the reshaping of geopolitical spaces so that certain groups, certain political groups are more likely to win despite who lives in certain areas, right? So it's like the shape is weird. You're like, oh, this is a made up shape in order to make this district, as opposed to it just being, this is a district, this is a district, this is a district, like they're all, like that would almost be more obvious to an 8-year old. And I think voting should be as simple as you can explain it to an 8-year old. And so that is not what exists in the United States. And I don't know that any place has done it perfectly, because humans are imperfect, and part of life is a constant striving towards the goal. It is not necessarily just the achieving of it. And you could also make the argument that it's not inherently just capitalism that is flawed. I would argue that capitalism in and of itself does not facilitate communal abundance because of literally the definition of the word is about personal profit. But we see similar outcomes and impacts in socialist democracies or socialist nations like in Cuba, right? We still see a colored pattern of who has and has not, especially during disaster or trouble. So it is not as simple as the economic system. I think it does mean we have to change the system foundationally.
So if we're talking about changing the system, so I look at individuals like you and you know, I don't think an individual can spark the change, like just what happened with George Floyd. But I think that there would need be some kind of like collective effort from like certain organizations. So in the Caribbean, I've forgotten the name now. So they have like a collective, whatever, where the countries are fighting for reparations as a collective. Mm-hmm. So in the US, do you have such kind of organizations? Do you have national, do you have international organizations that are forming counter narrative for fighting the system, you know, as a collective?
So there are multiple organizations that are working on narrative change work that are seeking reparations. There isn't necessarily one unified voice or speaker. That being said, that is hopefully shifting in the next few years and has been shifting over the past few years as people have started to recognize we need to work together. I mean, this has been the strategy of the right, which is already just like a strange paradigm to discuss, because within the political right, there are people who are impoverished and harmed by policies that are created by people that they voted for. So that division is flawed in a lot of ways. If anyone's interested, they can check out William Barber's White Poverty book, and he talks about this. But it requires strategy and time, but a sort of an urgent patience, right? So not like, let's just wait and see and hope for the best, because that won't work. But an understanding that this might not happen in our lifetime, in my lifetime, potentially, but that we need to keep laying these bricks. But I would argue that one person can make a change or instigate and be a part of change, especially when people are gathering around it. And the way that I simply argue that is Trump was elected. And now look at what will happen to the United States, what is already happening. Look at the cadre that has been formed around him to use him and to use this moment as a jumping off platform. So it is, one person can be quite empowered. And it's interesting because if you look at how close it was in this election for the Harris ticket versus the Trump ticket, Trump just barely won. But the team that is structuring narrative change around that narrative, the narrative story around that election would have us believe that most people in this country wanted this. The vast majority, which isn't the case. But here we are. and change is coming. And I think that's important to recognize also, is that change is not inherently good or bad. Change is just different.
Yeah.
And so this change that's coming will be bad.
Yeah, it's speaking of that, and speaking of how very divisive this election was. So your Early White Lies is a very interesting piece, and I think it does mirror also, you know, sometimes when we talk about, kind of like for me, debunks the white privilege narrative, where you say, oh, you're white, you're better than, which is still the divide and rule kind of stuff. You could come over here and talk about the Irish are white, they might be like, we had it bad as well. So I think what I think is potentially saying, what your piece is potentially saying is, listen, it is about the rich and the poor, regardless. I don't know if that's how I read that Early White Lies, but I think what I'm saying effectively for this reparation campaign to work, you need to have the support of other races outside of the black race. I don't know if that's,
I mean, that's absolutely true. I would say, so this Elite White Lies is the first part of an extended love letter. And so really the goal of that first part of the love letter, that edition of RX Reparations, is to offer a historical grounding of this concept of white supremacy. didn't actually include all white people. As anyone who is Irish descendant will tell you, as anyone who is Scottish descendant will tell you, as anyone who is English descendant should be able to, but may only possibly be able to tell you if you know, history is has been taught, passed down to them, is that, yes, many people who are now called white were descended from people who were exploited, from whom labor was extracted. That they had the potential to become white is a part of the white supremacy lie. I think, and I'll talk about this in coming editions, but it's not that white privilege doesn't exist. It absolutely does. These policies are affirmative action for white people. That, like, that historically cannot be denied. That is, you look at the black-white wealth gap in the US and it's like, well, the numbers are there. It is very clear that even if you are technically impoverished and white and have graduated only elementary school, you still hold more wealth than the average. That average story of an impoverished white person still holds more wealth, usually in the form of land or home ownership, than a black professional who's graduated postgraduate, like has degrees. And that's because of intergenerational wealth, right? So I'm not disputing those facts. Those are facts. What I want to sort of unpack, though, is that white supremacy protects certain white people, very specific and a small class, and that the story that has been told about white supremacy, even the reality of it, in some ways, when we focus on just the white part of the supremacy, it creates these divisions that Fred Hampton and the Rainbow Coalition understood. No, like, poor white people, you still don't know where your next meal's coming from. You still can't access healthcare. But because you have been fed this lie of white supremacy, of white race being the best race, being the superior race, part of it is you feel more connected. William Barber also talks about this in White Poverty. You feel more connected, or you're told that you should feel more connected to a white person in privilege, ideally a white man in privilege, in power. And then you choose this person who does not create policies that make your life better or more joyful, will take away your ability to access even the minimal healthcare that you can access now, that will diminish your capacity for an education in a country where higher education only happens for a third of the population, but higher education is tied to longer and healthier lives. And education after high school is not even considered a human right. So you don't actually have the right in the United States to a longer, healthier life.
Makini, let me disaggregate this white. Let me disaggregate and go to the gender part of it. So I've read and I've seen that, you know, sometimes when we talk about slavery and talk about all of this, sometimes I talk about it as a male, but there's been studies, recent studies that have shown that the white women as well own slaves. They also participated in it. So if you look at that and look at also the support that maybe people like Trump have received from white women in the US, for instance. And what is the gender dynamics of that? See, and if you look at how, you know, if I talk about suffragettes and all that, or that kind of stuff, women, I think black women also played the role, but white women really played the role as well in terms of fighting to have the right to vote. White women, well, white women are also beneficiary of that white privilege that we talk about. Yeah. So how do you see all these gender dynamics with women also being a victim and in a way also perpetrators of you know, their involvement in the whole enslavement, why it's the Atlantic slave trade?
I mean, it's I think impossible and it's ahistorical and sort of really just a lie to not recognize all of the entanglement of all of these things, white supremacy, patriarchy. It is cis heteronormativity, all of it works together to maintain power in an elite group of hands, in a specific group of people. And I can't speak to the psyches of every individual white person, right? Because they're not all thinking the same thing. They're not all coming from it from the same angle, even. There is also the, I don't know what the word is for, like, the equivalent of racism, but in the use of religion. But you know, do you know what I mean? Like, the concept that Christianity is the most important, it is the best religion, it is the most valued or the right one, for example, the same way that the idea that white supremacy perpetuates that whiteness is right, yeah. that patriarchy would have us believe that maleness is inherently right and better. I don't know. I can't say that I can explain away or understand why necessarily a white woman would vote for example, President-elect Trump. It seems to be not in, from my understanding of the policies that are coming down the pike, in anyone's interest, right? Yeah. But if you are a white woman who is married to a white man, and you have means, financial means, in a settler colonial capitalist system, you're probably going to be okay for the most part. There are certain exigent circumstances, certainly. God forbid you live in a state where currently abortion is essentially illegal and you need an abortion to save your life. Well, you have means. You can get out, even of the country, to do that. You shouldn't have to, but you have the means to survive without, you know, really just hoping for the best.
Yeah.
So for the most part, a lot of the policies that Project 25, that President Trump's administration, and really it's a three-branch administration now, are going to try to pursue and pass, are ultimately harmful, but it may not be clearly harmful in its most obvious impact. So those unintended consequences, or intended consequences, frankly, but those long-term consequences may not be abundantly clear to folks right away. And that is partially on purpose.
There's something in the last, I think you still.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, in the last whatever, we've seen like conscious, like you could see maybe during the Civil War as well, like the US Civil War, you see that concept of Pan-Africanism, and you see, you know, people talking about, I think it was Gavi now, in American, you know, the host of others they're talking about. But we've also seen in recent times where people are voluntarily like relocated to places like Ghana and stuff like that. So how do you see, how does that relate to, I think, were they giving slaves that wanted to move to the Freetown, to Sierra Leone at the time, I think they were giving them some money to relocate or something like that.
That was the proposition and the plan for some. It's a bit, to me, and this is more of a personal opinion than like, these are the facts. But my personal opinion is based in fact, and that is, I have never lived in another country. My parents have never lived in another country. My mother's parents have never lived in another country. Like, this is mine, just as much as it's anyone else's, in the sense of where my culture is, who my people are. If I were to relocate to Ghana, first of all, I have worked on the African continent in multiple countries. Only in one country did people say, oh, in Rwanda, they said, you know, if we didn't know, we might think maybe you were from here. But nowhere on the continent.
I think I can see, but I can see other places as well. I can see maybe the nose, the, you know, the way the cheese would.
But that's just phenotype, right? But the way that I walk, the way that I talk, the way that I move in the world, they know that I am not Rwandese. They know that I am not Liberian. They know I'm not Congolese. I'm not Sierra Leone. Like, it's, they know. And that's, and I mean, I'm not mad about that, right? Like, that's okay. That's totally fine, because it's true. I'm from the US. When I am in the UK, people ask me, are you from Canada or the US? I'm here in US. Like, they know I'm not from the African continent. They're not thinking Kenya. So I shouldn't be.
But you're saying that not based on, you're saying that based on your accent, which will be obvious.
It's based on my accent, right? Because I'm of the Western world. So it's not that I necessarily move differently in the Western world that they recognize me. It's the way that I talk. But when I am in a country of color, they do not think I'm from there. Right? And that's not based on, I have said any words. That is truly based on, they pass me in the street and they're like, she's not.
The system's not there.
You know, and that's okay. But that is essentially me moving to Ghana, me moving to South Africa, me moving to Mozambique, is me either seeking asylum or being a refugee.
I don't think anyone should. I think.
No, I know you're not saying that we should have to, but for me, it's like, no, I think we need to figure out how to get in right relationship with Native nations who have the longest time, ancestral history here, the longest ancestral history here, and find a way to be here in a good way. Yeah, it's for me, that's what it is. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I've had speaking of Africa, I've had a lot of Black Americans, some that are like back to the same conversation, some that have been privileged. And the way they talk, and I've heard, I know you might know this guy, he's a character. What was his name? No, Justin White. Sometimes I listen to Justin White talk, and you know, like, oh, we're grateful to be here, you know, in support of Trump's, you know, something we feel like, in support of what they feel Trump represents, like maybe conservatism against maybe, you know, what they call like woke liberalism and all that kind of stuff. So they would say, oh, I'm great from here. I mean, I'm Black. I'm in America. I'm not in Africa. You know, that kind of stuff. You know, they create that kind of like, you know, it's like it's a privilege. Like, you know, I'm grateful that I'm here. You know, it's like a talk, like the art of tokenism, rather than seeing, look, I am also equally a member of this place. I deserve to be here. It shouldn't be something, you know, does that create that inequality that, you know, when I see such narrative, I see people talk like that, even people at that level, what it tells me is, like you rightly said, your mom's mom were born in this place. That is rightfully your home. But you still see people still talking in terms of like, oh, we're lucky to be here.
So that sort of angle to it is the ingestion of white supremacist ideology that, number one, doesn't understand that Africa is not a country, right? And number two, assumes, because they have been taught what it means to be African and live African, as if that there's not a diversity of ways, number one, but number two, as if that inherently is bad. Inherently, you will be poor, you will be hungry, things will go poorly for you. That is that sense of I'm grateful to even just be here, right? That's like, oh, I'm just grateful to be nominated for the Oscar. Like, I don't even have to win. You know, that's not where I'm coming from. Although I mean, you're right, like people do have that sense. And it's not, for me, it's not necessarily a sense of ownership. I don't own this place. I don't have any more right to this land than anyone else who comes here. Freedom of movement, I think, is a natural human right. People have been leaving climate crises since people have existed on this earth. There are obviously a lot more climate crises now because what people have done, especially Western societies have done to this earth. But I am descendant of Mohawk people, of Scottish and English people, of Black people who I don't know what places, because they wouldn't have even necessarily been called countries, right? But what people they came from. I'm a descendant of all these people, but this is my home. And home is what I know. It is where I am from. These are my people. All of these people are my people. This experience is what is mine, not this land isn't. I don't own it. And I get to gatekeep who comes in.
Right? I agree. So
it's a different understanding, I think, than I'm just grateful to be here.
Marquis, before I see the last question, I want to see if you agree with me. Whilst we were talking, there's I don't know if you know Walter Rodney. So Rodney, you know him?
No, I'm saying say more to see if I can.
Oh, he's written something like the Black Skin, white and Black Skin, and written something about, you know. So all of these guys in the 70s or whatever, they wrote about, when they were talking about the independence that Africa got, they were like, that is just flag waving. So independence, true independence, isn't the mind. It's psychological independence. So what I'm saying, in essence, I don't know if you've thought about psychological reparations, if that is even possible. Because, you know, the way the mind has been abused, and over generation, there are some tropes, some narratives that you've accepted yourself to be. Because we might be talking about financial reparation, talk about all of this. But if you, as an individual, you've accepted your subordinates or level, you've accepted it. Have we looked at reparation in that aspect in terms of how do you disabuse the mind? How do you empower people from the mind to say over years? Some people have lost their language. They've lost. So how can you even, reparation is, have we looked at it in that wider scope? I don't know if you've ever thought about that.
I haven't looked at it from a historical or methodological perspective, psychological reparations. What my gut tells me is this. Number one, that's therapy. That's years of therapy. And education, understanding where that comes from. The drive to know why, like, that's like a three-year-old's favorite word, right? Like, it's the natural, we want to know why. Yeah. Why do I think this? Why was I taught this? What did that serve? Who did that benefit? But ultimately, while I think there is a level of psychological power, psychic freedom that you can have, right? So there are people who are like, I might be in prison in these walls, but like, I am free. Mm-hmm. That's big stuff. That's Buddha level enlightenment. But at a population level, if people are hungry, if they don't have a place to live, if they cannot survive a tornado hitting their home, like you gotta do the basics first. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that at the population level for Black people, mm-hmm. or Indigenous people, mm-hmm. in this country. Mm-hmm. And so I think those two things go hand in hand, but just like was taught in the Bible, you feed people with food first.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. You don't tell them, oh, like your time is coming, like heaven and da da da. No, you feed them now. You tell them the good news while you feeding them. If people aren't surviving, literally alive and able to, then everything else is a lie. That's a distraction. You're trying to prevent me from getting what I deserve as a human being. And when I have that, then I have time, the luxury to go to therapy.
Let me ask you I'm going to give you to conclude with this, like, but before I say that, there's this Afro-American, he's worked with several presidents. I think he worked so he's talked about this five layers, how the Black American can grow. He's talking about using economics. He put economics at the top, then education. I was sending his name when I think he was a brilliant, he did appear on the Breakfast Club, talk about this levels of stuff. But the last question I was going to say to you, how do you see this campaign in the short term, medium, and the long term?
Oof. The short term, medium, and long term will absolutely require narrative structuring, restructuring, and has been moving forward in that vein in the past few years of defining reparations, explaining why. Like, what happened? So many people in this country didn't get the honest, true, comprehensive, inclusive history of the U.S. and how it was built. So that part is essential. I think the other part that you mentioned before, that white relatives have to be involved. Certainly it has to be the populations that have been harmed at the leadership, but we all have to be, it has to be co-created. Right? For what we currently have and for the system that we have now to deconstruct itself, it has to involve many more of us. And the thing is, there are many more of us. We keep growing. So this isn't a fringe movement. This isn't a freakish thing that like, oh, they just, and I think there's a quote that has been resonating with me that everyone has heard in the past couple days that is attributed to Mahatma Gandhi. Mr. Gandhi said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. The conversation has been ignored for so long. It was laughed at. Now they're fighting. And if I interpret, the anti-DEI movement, the weaponization of the word woke, that isn't a weapon at all. Like, yes. I'm awake. I'm aware. I can see. I have learned. I am learning. That is a fight. And they only fight when they think you can win.
Yeah.
So we're one step away.
Yeah. Yeah. Agree. Makes sense. Makenia, you know we could talk all day. If I'm gonna have to maybe I have to bring you back for party. It's been an amazing time. And you know, I share most of your ideas and you know your optimism and you know the fight and the struggle, you know, for truth, you know, regardless of you know, I'm always on the side of the victims. I'm always on the side of people that have been oppressed. You know, regardless of their color, regardless, like when you started, you said reparation is not all about race. You did mention that, so yeah, I'm always on the part of truth. And yes, it's been an amazing time, and I would keep following your amazing stuff. You're a great writer, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for reading RX Reparations. I'm excited for us to meet in person someday. Well, so much. I'm very grateful and deeply honored that you invited me. Thank you.
Same here. All right, go have a rest from the shift. All right, and then we'll see. Thank you very much, Shane
McKinnon. Okay, yeah, take care.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. To this week's episode, an interesting episode. What a wonderful episode with Dr. Makenia Chisom-Straka, a U.S. Reparation consultant. Join me as usual to thank her for her rich and varied, exciting views on reparations. As usual, join me to thank her, and I would encourage you to subscribe if you have not subscribed. And share this video and join me next week for another inspiring, exciting episode. For now, stay blessed.